In the spoken meditation, Carol shared with us some of the important ways, large and small, that we each can and do contribute to building the beloved community in this place. And often in UU circles, you hear that phrase, building the beloved community. But I'm not sure, although it's a nice phrase, that we always know exactly what it means. The term beloved community was coined by the early 20th century American philosopher Josiah Royce, but most of us learned it not from Royce, but from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who often spoke of the beloved community as the ultimate goal of his life's work. As an early example, after the Montgomery bus boycotts and speaking about where do we go from here, what is our final goal, MLK said, "The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opponents into friends. It is this love that can bring about a miracle in the hearts of men." Now, notice what King is not saying. He's not saying what we're often accustomed to hearing in our highly competitive society. He's not saying that the end goal is a decisive and crushing victory over your opponent. That's not what he's saying. So, for King, building beloved community requires the even harder work than destroying your opponent. It's the harder work of reconciliation, of redemption, of being in right relationship, of transforming former opponents into friends. As Dr. King said in his 1967 A Christmas Sermon for Peace, "We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your hearts and to your conscience that we will also win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory." That's what he meant by a love which will bring about a miracle in the hearts of men. Practices like nonviolent activism that break open the hearts of your opponents, confronting them with the inherent worth and dignity of yourself or the inherent worth and dignity of people and groups that were falsely believed to be less than human. And this isn't abstract at all in our history. You know, there are those awkward moments on, like, Constitution Day when people will say, "Oh, it'd be a good idea to read through the whole U.S. Constitution." And then you get to those awkward parts about the Indians or the awkward parts about that certain groups are only 3/5 of everyone else. So this whole idea of confronting people with the inherent worth and dignity of all people and groups is no small and can be quite a transformative practice. According to the King Center, which maintains Dr. King's legacy, for King, the beloved community was not a lofty utopian goal to be confused with the rapturous image of the peaceable kingdom where the lion shall lay down with the lamb in idyllic harmony. Rather, the beloved community was for him a realistic, achievable goal that could be attained by a critical mass of people trained in nonviolent activism. For Dr. King, the beloved community was also a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth. In the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human dignity will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood as we realize we're all part of the same human family. In the beloved community, international disputes will be resolved by international conflict resolution and reconciliation of adversaries instead of by military means. Love and trust will triumph over fear and hatred, and peace with justice will prevail over war and military conflict. Dr. King's bold vision of a beloved community is deeply resonant with our UU principles, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are all a part, that we are deeply connected. But to what extent is this vision of beloved community, albeit compelling, to what extent is it realistic? To look even farther back, the vision of beloved community in many ways is just a secularized version of what Jesus called the kingdom of God. But too often, Jesus and the way he's depicted in our culture sounds a little too much like the White Queen from Alice in Wonderland, who you may recall said, "It's just all about believing six impossible things before breakfast." That is not what following Jesus is about. Rather, it's about practicing the same radical compassion and kindness in our day that he did in his day. A love that dares to transgress cultural and tribal divisions. And from that perspective, I think that G.K. Chesterton's view on Christianity applies equally to Dr. King's beloved community. And that is that these visions have not been tried and found wanting. They've been found difficult and not tried. To give just one example, remember that for Dr. King, the beloved community was a realistic, achievable goal that could be attained by a critical mass of people trained in nonviolent activism. And given the effectiveness that we have seen of nonviolent movements through Dr. King, through Gandhi, and others in the 20th century, what would it mean to really work toward having a critical mass of people trained in this alternative paradigm? What might it look like if we reallocated even 1% of our tremendously large military budget for nonviolent activist training, and then 2% the next year, and then 3%? How might such a paradigm shift help us move away from what Dr. King called the three greatest threats to building beloved community? That is, racism, materialism, and militarism. So racism, dividing ourselves into tribes instead of seeing that we are part of one human family. Materialism, some people having too much while some people don't even have a bare minimum. And militarism, thinking that every problem has to be solved through violent intervention. In our own lives, what would it mean like to seek to communicate with one another, even when we're stressed, less with harshness, less with violence, and more with compassion and nonviolence? Allow me to take another step back toward the interpersonal level with a story. During my childhood, the closest glimpse I ever had to what the beloved community might look like was probably at summer camp. How many of you grew up going to like weeks-long summer camp? All right, maybe about half. That's my camp people in the congregation. Starting at age 10, I attended a camp in Black Mountain, North Carolina for 2 weeks each summer, which extended to 4 weeks at age 16, about 6 weeks at age 17, and then to about 10 to 12 weeks each summer throughout college as I became a counselor and then an age group director and then a waterfront director before spending a final 6 weeks as the water ski director. So, as a young child, those 2 weeks each summer were like an almost perfect, idyllic, beloved community. And I would sometimes think, well, we should just have the whole world live in summer camp all the time. But of course, summer, as this morning's temperature reminds us, is but one season of the year and depends on work and the other seasons to support vacations. And in retrospect, I can also see other angles that were invisible to me as a child, such as the tremendous race and class privilege that afforded me the opportunity to be able to go away for 2 weeks a summer. Also, as I became not a camper, but a counselor charged with the responsibility of holding the container that made this camp experience possible, I began to see that the summer was an exhausting sprint for the adults. And while exhilarating, was not sustainable year-round. As a child, I also envied the lives of the five owners of the camp who lived there year-round in the off-season. They were such fascinating people, and I used to think that even if camp, this was quite a large camp, even if it wasn't sustainable for about 400 campers and 150 staff year-round, well, surely it was sustainable. You know, they must have such an amazing time when all of us went away and the five of them and their families could, have this beloved community together. But again, as I grew up and I entered the inner circle of the central staff, I began to see that even these phenomenal human beings, these camp owners and directors who did so much to create this camp experience each summer, they were human beings, just like the rest of us, with imperfections, with rivalries. And that for the most part, they retreated to their respective homes with their families during the off-season. They just didn't just have beloved community all the time. My experience at summer camp was one of the earlier lessons in both the possibilities and the pitfalls of building the beloved community. And that spirit allowed me to share with you just one more story, this time from our Unitarian Universalist heritage. In the 18th and 19th centuries, our Unitarian and Universalist forebears in many ways defined themselves against a pessimistic Calvinism. So you remember John Calvin's from the 1500s, the Reformation. He's the one that burned Michael Servetus at the stake for teaching Unitarian ideas. So that in many ways in the 1700s and 1800s, our Unitarian and Universalist forebears were defining themselves against that sort of worldview. They were rejecting the idea that human nature is, as Calvin described, about total depravity. Instead, they said, no, we have inherent worth and dignity, and we've inherited that as today as our first principle. Instead of some people being predestined to an eternal torment, what sometimes has been called by, like, Jonathan Edwards, sinners in the hands of an angry God, they said, no, that sounds like God in the hands of angry sinners. They said, no, divine love is for all, and that's where our universalist, the universal love for humanity, that's where that half of our heritage comes from, which eventually came to be about loving the hell out of this world. And instead of a top-down, all-powerful, all-controlling God, they emphasized human freedom and human responsibility. So instead of a Calvinistic pessimism, they had tremendous optimism about the potential both of human beings and for our society and the communities we might build together. The most well-known distillation of that perspective was from our 19th century Unitarian minister, James Freeman Clark, who characterized this new liberal theology as about the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the leadership of Jesus, salvation by character, and the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. Now remember, this is the late 19th century. Second wave feminism didn't come to the 1970s, so he's using sexist language, of course. But the fatherhood of God, that we're all part of this one human family, and long before John Lennon's Imagine, you know, the brotherhood of man. And the leadership of Jesus, because in the 19th century, remember, humanism didn't come in our movement till the early 20th century. So they're seeing Jesus as pointing them toward this way of realizing that we are all brothers and sisters. And then salvation, not by grace alone or faith alone, but no, salvation by character, by your ethics, by how you live your life. And then finally, the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. So you can hear that 19th century coming out of the Industrial Revolution, that tremendous hope in the progress of our species. But that optimism did not rest solely with our forebears. 119 communal and utopian societies were established in the United States between 1800 and 1859. So that's the first half of the 19th century before the Civil War. And more than half of them were formed in what is known as the frenetic 40s, the 1840s, a decade marked by some of the most intense reform and fervor that our country has ever witnessed. I'd like to share with you only about one of them, Brook Farm, a utopian experiment by some of our transcendentalist forebears. The Unitarian George Ripley, unlike Emerson, left his Unitarian pulpit for the lecture circuit. George Ripley left it because he said, I want to practice what I've been preaching. I want to actually try living this way and building this community. And they wanted to experiment with creating what they called the City of God, what we might call the beloved community, on a 200-acre dairy farm called Brook Farm, about 9 miles outside of the Promised Land, Boston. I think I've told you all the joke before, right? They said in the 19th century, Unitarianism was about the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the neighborhood of Boston, so near Harvard. So Sterling Delane, the author of Brook Farm, The Dark Side of Utopia, writes that this community of Brook Farm is often nostalgically recalled as this bucolic retreat in which days began with the choruses of Mozart and Haydn by the Brook Farm choir. Afternoons were interrupted to read Dante's great work in the original Italian. Evenings feature dramatic tableau and lectures and dancing, and life at Brook Farm often did in many ways resemble the sort of Arcadian adventure. But what is rarely acknowledged is the desperation that came from unrelieved financial pressures, the loss of faith in Brook Farm's leaders, and the class antagonisms that often smoldered just beneath the surface of this community civility. Now, as you may can guess, when you're accustomed to this sort of, you know, urban, literary, life of the mind in Boston coming out of Harvard, it turns out that a few months of reading agricultural books are actually not sufficient preparation, you know, physically, mentally, financially, to run a 200-acre dairy farm and turn it into an agricultural paradise. And although the Transcendentalist residents of Brook Farm found this sort of country living to be invigorating in many ways, a huge initial setback was that after 5 months of almost back-breaking labor, they still had no reliable source of income, or even more alarmingly, any feasible financial plan to sustain the association's future operations. Laura shared with you a little. Brook Farms actually lasted for about 6 years, from 1841 to 1847, but Laura mentioned Little Women and Louisa May Alcott. So her father, Bronson Alcott, was part of the Transcendentalist Circle, and he started another community called Fruitlands, and that has the unenviable recognition of being the least successful of, so I think it lasted like 6 months, so it was a spectacular failure. But the Brook Farms did last for 6 years, but the two tragedies that finally forced the community to collapse were two. First, and here I'll let you draw your own parallels to today, there was a smallpox outbreak in November of 1845. Why? They didn't get vaccinated. Second, in March of the following year, an accidental fire destroyed a major new building project, which had never been insured. And so that added a devastating loss on top of an already pre-existing financial strain. Now, there are a lot of potential lessons for us today, potentially, from these utopian social hopes. One is that intention does not always equal impact. The residents of Brook Farm, particularly George Ripley and a few of the other leaders, they had the best of intentions, and they actually worked extremely hard. But that is no guarantee of progress onward and upward forever, as many small business owners can tell you. Just, you may have the entrepreneurial spirit, but it may or may not work out. Another lesson in retrospect is to not neglect your strengths. The founders of Brook Farm had this sort of lofty, abstract, agrarian ideal of what the farming life should be. But they didn't have any farming or business experience previously to speak of. But they were highly educated in general, as you heard about, you know, those reading Dante in the original and these, you know, opening with Mozart and Haydn in the morning and having these plays and tableaus and lectures. But they didn't focus on the boarding school at Brook Farm. So they had this boarding school, but it was kind of this thing they did on the side. They just felt like, what we really have to do is, you know, make it as farmers, this sort of, before Jefferson, this kind of Jeffersonian ideal. Even though for them, education of children probably had the most strong chance of being a reliable income stream that wouldn't be affected by the vagaries of weather, as agriculture is. For instance, whereas none of the other antebellum New England communities had more than one college-educated teacher involved in their education program, Brook Farm had three college-educated teachers. But they didn't make a big deal out of that. They didn't promote that. They didn't make that a core of their mission. Part of what I'm building towards is that whereas the Calvinists were far too pessimistic about human nature and societal hopes, our 19th century forebears overcorrected with an overly naive hope in human potential and societal progress, particularly about how easy and inevitable such progress would be on both the individual and institutional level. But today we live on the other side of the 20th century, World War I. World War II, Vietnam, Watergate. And part of the reason that the Brook Farm story is also poignant for me is that my childhood summer camp that I was telling you about earlier, that was founded in 1956, the two previous decades, that mountain valley around Lake Eden was the home of a radical experimental learning community some of you may have heard of called Black Mountain College. So that you know, Lake Eden, where I swam in the summer and eventually became waterfront director, there was amazing, incredible learning going on there for about two decades previously. Visitors included pathbreaking figures such as philosopher John Dewey, playwright Thornton Wilder, novelist Henry Miller, writer Aldous Huxley, musician John Cage. Buckminster Fuller erected the first geodesic dome on the field where I learned to play soccer and ultimate frisbee. It was a breathtakingly beautiful sight with incredibly well-intentioned and gifted and innovative thinkers and artists and educators. But similar to Brook Farm, money was always an issue. When the college disbanded every April, no one really knew if they would get their act together during the summer in order for it to open during the fall. And eventually, in the mid-50s, they didn't get their act together, and it didn't reopen, and it was bought and became a summer camp, as it is to this day. And part of why I wanted to preach this morning on the subject of utopian social hopes and building the beloved community is this afternoon at 4 o'clock, again, we're all invited to gather again in this sanctuary to celebrate our shared ministry together in an installation service formally recognizing the shift from being a contract minister to me being your called settled minister. And the most compelling reason that I chose congregational ministry over academia or other career paths is that I was getting wary of just reading people's abstract ideas about what people should be like or what the religious community should be like or what society should be like. And instead, I became increasingly interested in the concrete reality of what is possible, actually making something happening and testing it out in the crucible of real life right here in this building and in our connections, you know, around Frederick. That's what is compelling and interesting to me, what is actually possible, not just what is theoretically possible. And one of the reasons I chose Unitarian Universalism is that I share the social hopes of Josiah Rice and Dr. King, of Black Mountain College and Brook Farms. But as a citizen of the early 21st century, on the other side of all that happened and transpired in the 20th century, I also want to learn from their mistakes, even as I am grateful that we stand on the shoulders of giants, some tremendously innovative and creative and pathbreaking people that went before us. So I'm incredibly grateful for all that we have accomplished together over the last few years, and I look forward to working with you in building the beloved community for many years to come. As we continue to reflect on where we find our respective places in building the beloved community, I invite you to rise in body or spirit as we sing together hymn 121, Come Build a Land. That we have only in the early service, it reminded me of Howard Thurman and thinking about the failure of Brook Farm to emphasize its strengths. And some of you may know Howard Thurman. He was on the West Coast, really involved with a lot of he was not Unitarian, but involved with a lot of Unitarians, founded, I think it was called the Church of, it wasn't of All Souls, All Peoples, I think is what it was called. And Howard Thurman wrote, he was an African-American minister, he wrote a book called Jesus and the Disinherited, and that was the one book that Dr. King carried in his briefcase in addition to the Bible. He was always carried a copy of Howard Thurman's Jesus and the Disinherited in addition to the Bible. But the relevant quote, I think, that may be helpful for us today is that Howard Thurman always used to tell people, don't ask yourself what the world needs. Don't ask yourself, don't let that be your starting point, what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is more people who are really alive and passionate about what they're doing in the world. So as you go from this place, continue your journey walking in love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And know that whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace, or joy, that goes with you out into the world. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.